things to read yesterday. One of the, I don't know, advantages, disadvantages of being a scientist is you get to go to lots of meetings, most of which are unbelievably dull, but some are actually quite interesting. And there are people used to write everything on transparencies and then put them on these overhead projectors. Now, of course, it's PowerPoint. And one of the things that people do is then read off their PowerPoint slides, and I always think, oh my goodness, that's very dull. And so I didn't do that yesterday. On the other hand, it occurred to me that it's way back there, and I have no idea whether you can actually read that stuff from back there. Okay, now not everybody could, because I asked some people. Well, I'll read the more interesting or scurrilous things, but leave out the duller. So we'll start. Today I want to talk about the invention of the calculus and Gottfried Leibniz. The history of science is replete with arguments over priority. There's ego, there's fame, there's power, there's aggression, there's even money, and there's even patriotism are all involved. But of all such disputes, and having been involved in one or two of them myself at very low level, I think there is the most infamous of all is that between those two remarkable giants, Isaac Newton and Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. What began as a dispute about the discovery of the calculus eventually involved physics, philosophy, theology, and involved many of the most important men, and unfortunately in those days they were all men, in the history of mathematics. Now, the facts of the matter are not in doubt. I mean, it's now more than 300 years since the dispute began, and scholars have spent innumerable lifetimes investigating, so we know the facts really very well. The calculus, which is surely the single most important tool, mathematical tool for science, was invented by Isaac Newton. Its implications were understood by him, and he applied it to solving the problems of physics. It's equally true that Gottfried Leibniz discovered it independently, that he was the first person to publish his work, and it was he and his colleagues on the continent who really developed all of its applications. And in fact, he has also invented the notation that we still use to this day. Genius, of course, in no way applies wisdom. And this argument, which brought in such amazingly famous people as Brooke Taylor, David Gregory, John Wallace, and Johann Bernoulli, I have lots of good stories about Bernoulli, was clearly the longest and the most bitter of Newton's life. And the destructive side of Newton's character, I think, is nowhere more evident than it is in this dispute. Gottfried Leibniz was born in 1646, 4 years after Newton, making him again an approximate contemporary. And he was born in Leipzig. Again, as with Newton, Flamsteed, and Hooke, Leibniz lost a parent at a fairly young age, his father dying when he was six. But Leibniz's father was a professor of moral philosophy at the University of Leipzig, and so not born into either a wealthy or a noble family, he was at least born into a learned family. And using his father's library, he taught himself Latin by the age of eight, he taught himself Greek by the age of 12, he entered the University of Leipzig by the age of 15, where he read law. But it was at Leipzig if you think that's impressive, wait, I mean, Thomas Young, whom I talk about next week, could read fluently at two, had read the Bible twice at four. That I find impressive. I mean, I have grandchildren that age, they just learn to talk. But at university, he became familiar with the great thinkers of his day, with Bacon, with Galileo, with Descartes, with Kepler, etc. And it was at university that his interest in mathematics was sparked. Now, I took courses in philosophy as an undergraduate, and read things by Leibniz, which I found relatively difficult to understand at that age. But I had no idea he was a brilliant mathematician, and he was an incredible mathematician. By the time he graduated, he was offered a professor's chair in philosophy at the University of Nuremberg, but he declined that. But whilst an undergraduate, he published a paper in the law in which he, one of the first people, stressed the importance of legal precedent in making decisions, obviously something that has lasted. Now, clever young people attract the attention of their elders, and he attracted the attention of a politician from Mainz who suggested, and was done, that this essay that he wrote was dedicated to the elector of Mainz. And that got him a court position at Mainz, which he needed, of course. And all of his life he needed to make a living, which was a difficult problem for him. So he was now in Mainz. Now, many of the German states in this time, and we're talking about roughly 1670, were very worried about the influence of the French under Louis XIV. And to divert their attention, the people in Mainz developed a plan. The plan had two parts. The first part was to divert the French from an interest in Germany to an interest in the great mercantile power of the time, Holland. And secondly, to interest the French in, as a Catholic nation, in attacking the Turks, who had, through their possession of Egypt. The idea being that first you would divert the French, and secondly, Egypt was already important as a trade route to the east, and that might also harm the Dutch, although since they used this area, I don't know how important that might have been. Nonetheless, Leibniz went to Paris in 1672, about the time that Newton was beginning his argument with Robert Hooke. And the negotiations with the French came to naught, and the papers were then hidden away in German archives, rediscovered about over a century later by Napoleon, after their invasion of the parts of Germany. And Napoleon was really, I've read, quite impressed to find out that the first indication that the French should invade Egypt came from a man generally remembered as a philosopher and not as a statesman. But to understand the quarrel, we have to go back to the miracle years of 1665 and 66. Newton was in the peace of his mother's garden, or mother's house in Lincolnshire, and he spent most of his time working on the mathematics of infinite series. Now, to those of you who know much about mathematics, the step from infinite series to a limiting process, and therefore the invention of a derivative, doesn't seem very big. But in Newton's day, it was a step of breathtaking ingenuity and genius. Newton was almost entirely self-taught in mathematics, although he read and was influenced by the works of both Descartes and the English mathematician John Wallace. But he was able to both digest and greatly exceed them. It is clear he applied his mathematical ability to physics problems and motion problems, including gravity. And the mention of gravity brings to mind the apple in his mother's garden. Now, this well-known story was recorded independently by quite a number of people, but late in Newton's life, and whether it is true or not, I don't know. But I have a slide here, which... And it doesn't matter what that says. I don't care so much. But what it meant is he looked at the apple falling, right? And he said, now suppose the apple tree is up on a mountain. Will it still fall? The answer is obviously yes. How high can the mountain be?
I don't know.
Pretty high. Can it reach all the way to the moon? Yes, probably. And therefore, he came to the realization that probably it was the gravitational force, the same one that held him to the ground, that pulled the apple down, that held the moon in its orbit. And as I think I mentioned, he then went on to calculate the relationship between the distance to the moon and the period of the moon, 27.3 days, which everybody knew, but because he had the distance wrong, I mean, he didn't have Google to look it up, because he had the distance wrong, he didn't get the right, the two sides of his equation didn't agree, and so he put it away until Halley, some 15 years later, told him what straightened him out. Now, what I can't resist is this story is so good. I have a couple of cartoons. Now you probably, this one I doubt anybody can read, but they're all these sort of bearded guys sitting under a tree, and one says, "Nothing yet, Newton," and "Nothing yet, how about you, Newton?" And there's a gigantic apple over his head. And there's another one I found also on the web. Sir Isaac Newton's great, 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 great grandson. There's the apple falling. I thought that was really very clever. What I also find very interesting, is the apple should be the symbol of modern science. It's the apple of Newton that then occupied, and still in a way, occupies the modern mind. But prior to Newton, it was the apple of Eve that occupied people's interest. Deism, which becomes very strong in the 18th century, the wisdom of creation and the creator, the apple of wisdom, if you will, has become the focus of attention rather than sin and grace that is the apple of revelation. It's a big, big change, and I will talk about that tomorrow. But by 1667, Newton was done with mathematics. I mean, he had invented everything that was needed. But a year later, a book came out by Mercator, the same man who made the projection of the flat projection of the Earth that many of us learned about in school that makes Greenland look about five times too big. The book is called Logarithmotechnia. And Newton read it, and it's full of interesting mathematics, and he became very frightened that he had been anticipated in a lot of his work. So he quickly wrote a short, modest book, which called On Analysis by Infinite Series, but it's in Latin, and it's better known by its Latin title, De Analisi. Of course, he never published it. But he did show it around. It didn't get published till 1711, and it became Newton's proof, if you will, that he was first. Because some people read this, by 1669, Newton, who had not yet received his Master of Arts degree, was offered the Lucasian Professorship of Mathematics, the second person to hold that chair. He took it from Isaac Barrow, the first person of the chair. This chair, the Lucasian Professorship of Mathematics, from the years 1979 for 30 years to 2009, was held by a person everybody knows, I think, Stephen Hawking, who just quit it last year in favor of Michael Green. Newton's claims to the invention of the calculus are based on De Analisi from about 1669 and on another book called Treatise on the Method of Series and Fluxions. Newton calls the calculus the art of fluxions and anti-fluxions, derivatives and integrals in modern terms. And these papers make clear that his claims are absolutely valid. In addition, in 1669, he wrote another Latin manuscript, again unpublished, in which he discussed gravity, the concepts of centripetal force, and it was there that he demonstrated that the gravitational force is so much greater than the centrifugal force that would tend to spin us off. And somebody then asked me yesterday, if you really would weigh less at the equator than you do anywhere else? And the answer is, oh, absolutely. And so I calculated it last night. And if you're at the pole, hard to be, or if you're at the equator, your weight at the equator will be approximately 0.5% less than it is at the pole. So it's, it's better to stop to eat less. That's not the way to lose weight. I want to go back to Leibniz now, who was living in Paris at this time, from 1672 on, and it brought him into contact with lots of the greatest thinkers, and because of his interest in mathematics, the person most important to him was that Dutch mathematician, Christian Huygens, who was living there. Not only, by the way, he also imbibed both at university and in Paris the physical philosophy of Descartes, this idea I mentioned before of the mechanistic universe, that is, forces could only be involved by touching, real pushes and pulls, again, which makes the Earth's attraction to the sun quite a questionable thing. Leibniz managed had invented, when he was in Mainz, a calculating machine, and he brought this along to Paris and he demonstrated it to the Académie des Sciences in Paris. And then, as part of his diplomatic work, he went to London in 1673. He took the machine along with him. He showed it to the Royal Society. They were quite impressed. They elected him as a fellow. But whilst in London, he also discovered Mercator's book, also became fascinated and worried that some of his mathematical ideas had been preempted, and so he rushed back to Paris and convinced Christian Huygens to teach him. And he was a very bright guy. With much to learn, he read furiously, and then he wrote to Henry Oldenburg, whom you might remember was the secretary of the Royal Society, to inquire about the work of recent English mathematicians, and thus starts the controversy with Newton. Now, while Newton was arguing with Hooke over optics, Leibniz was making huge gains in mathematics. And a year later, he wrote to Oldenburg to reveal his first mathematical discovery. And this had to do with the area of a circle. Now, the area of a circle, as I hope everybody has learned at school, is pi times the radius squared. Now, since the radius is half of the diameter, if you want to put it in terms of the diameter, it becomes pi times the diameter squared upon 4. And if the diameter of the circle is 1, you are left with pi upon 4. And there is a series which he invented for pi upon 4, and he wrote this to Oldenburg. So that pi upon 4 is 1 minus a third plus a fifth minus a seventh plus a ninth minus an 11th, blah, 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 on ad infinitum, because, of course, pi is an irrational number, has an infinite number of terms. And he was very proud of this. Of course, he didn't know that Newton had already invented this almost about 8 years before. Oldenburg wrote back to him the following. What you tell me of the advance is good, but I should not like you to be unaware that this has also been done by James Gregory and by Isaac Newton. And it was through this letter that Leibniz first learned of the name of Isaac Newton. He was interested in what Newton did, and then there was silence until about the end of the year. And by the end of the year, Leibniz had invented the calculus, including, as I said, the notation still in use today, which Newton did not do. Newton, of course, was completely ignorant of Leibniz's existence in the world. What Newton did not know particularly is that in the correspondence between Oldenburg and Leibniz, Oldenburg had put some of Newton's work from De Analisi into the letters to Leibniz. So Leibniz had seen some of Newton's work. Newton could never credit how clever Leibniz was and that he could do this by himself. Surely, he thought, the speed with which Leibniz developed the calculus meant that he had to have help from somewhere. And where could he get help from except from the great Isaac Newton? But he never published anything. He slowed down the history of the development both of physics and mathematics by years and years. He's got nobody to blame, really, but himself. The Mainz job, this negotiation was done, and so poor Leibniz needed a job. And he desperately wanted to stay in Paris. He looked around as best he could for a job. So the situation, certainly in academia, has not changed a whit in 300 years. And the only job he could get was in Hanover for the Duke of Brunswick. And he spent about a year looking for jobs in Paris and couldn't find anything. Now, Leibniz, during this time, was writing desperate letters to Oldenburg asking for information. And the information he wanted was from James Gregory and Isaac Newton. But Gregory, by this time, was dead. And so the only person who could answer, of course, any of these things was Newton. And so Oldenburg wrote to Newton. And I think, to his great credit, Newton answered this unknown German mathematician living in Paris. And he wrote one of the most famous mathematical papers ever, the Epistola Prior, the early letter. And this remarkable document, which was written in June of 1676, is a virtual textbook on infinite series. It's really very good. Newton used to write this book. Newton made use of his invention of the calculus, although he made no mention of that whatsoever in the book. But here was this unknown foreigner, and Newton wrote this long letter to him. Because it was an important letter, Oldenburg wouldn't send it through the normal post, and he waited for somebody of sufficient honesty and character to carry it to Paris, and so it took about 2 months to get to Leibniz. Leibniz was deeply impressed, wrote back immediately to Newton via Oldenburg, as the person always in the middle. And in it, he demonstrated a lot of his own cleverness in mathematics as well. I mean, he was showing off also what he could do. In the middle of October 1676, Leibniz finally made his way to Hanover from Paris by the shortest possible route, namely via London, which did not. I mean, he obviously was very loath to go. Now, when in London, he did not meet Newton, who, of course, was still in Cambridge, but he did meet John Collins. Collins was an important figure in the Royal Society, not a great genius himself, but a man who put people together, did a lot of communicating, and was a very important character. Collins was very impressed by Leibniz's genius, and showed him things from De Analisi that he probably should not have. And this is going to be very important later on. But from the notes, again, people have looked at this for decades, maybe centuries, from the notes that Leibniz made, the notes he made were entirely on the infinite series and nothing about the calculus, because he had already invented the calculus. He didn't need anything that Newton had done. Then he went off to Hanover, and in late October of 76, Newton wrote another letter, the Epistola Posterior, in which, again, was a veritable textbook of mathematics. And this took, because Hanover is farther than Paris, this took about 8 months to get to Leibniz, again, because he was looking, Oldenburg was looking for a very safe way to send it. Now, it starts, this second letter starts with a long reflection on the binomial theorem. Newton was not prone to reflection, particularly until he was quite old, but at this time was an exception. Now, the binomial theorem, as I think I mentioned, is probably the second most important discovery in mathematics after the theorem of right triangles of Pythagoras. And so you'll excuse me, I can't help resist just putting it up because it's just so beautiful. This is one way of writing it, and it's just the most marvelous statement. Now, this document, had it been a little bit more specific, would have cemented Newton's claim to the calculus, and would have prevented this horrible, unnecessary, extremely bitter argument, But it probably would have greatly disappointed Leibniz because his wonderful discovery of the calculus had already been done. But Newton went to the edge of revelation and pulled back. And what he did was quite common in his age. He wrote out anagrams. Now, in the days before common publication, copyright, patents, what mathematicians often did was to write their ideas in some complicated anagram that only they understood, and this was established priority. Robert Hooke did that, and Newton did that. And to show you, he wrote two anagrams. The first is called the Fundamental Theorem of Calculus. To show you how easy it is to decipher, there it is. Okay. Now, good luck to Mr. Leibniz to figure that one out. And what it means is, given the equation involving any number of fluent quantities, that means in modern terms continuous quantities, to find the fluxions, the derivatives, and vice versa, the integral. In other words, to be able to use the calculus to work on it. And that's what it says. His second anagram, which was even longer, and I didn't bother because it would take up most of the page, is about the solution of complicated differential equations. Newton was urged over and over to publish something, and he didn't. And he made the statement, which I will read to you, "As for the apprehension that Monsieur Leibniz's method may be more general or more easy than mine, you will not find any such thing." How very wrong he was. Leibniz wrote an immediate reply upon getting the second letter, and he too came close to revealing what he knew. He too pulled back at the last minute. And there would have been further correspondence between these two men, but everything came to an end with the death of Henry Oldenburg in September of 77. Finally, in October of 1684, Newton was just starting work on the Principia, an article appeared called, in English, it was written in Latin, "A new method of maxima and minima and also tangents and a singular kind of calculus for them." This was published in a rather obscure Latin journal called the Acta Eruditorum, and it was published in Germany, and it was the vehicle chosen by Leibniz for the announcement to the world of the calculus. For the first time, this incredible branch of mathematics appeared in public. Nobody paid any attention. The first appearance in print of Newton's response did not occur until 1691, but in the Principia, Newton clearly knew about it because he writes a famous lemma. Now, I've used lemmas forever, but I didn't know how to define it, so I looked it up in the dictionary. A lemma is a subsidiary proposition introduced in proving some other proposition. So it's a kind of a helpful theorem. And he announced in this lemma, in the absolutely most obscure way, his discovery of the fluxions, that is, differentiation, and of his communication with that most skilled geometer, G.W. Leibniz. Newton was forced into some admission, but nobody could figure out from what he wrote what had happened. However, he went well beyond this, because by 1712, when there was really at the height of the argument between the two men, he then did the following disgraceful thing. He wrote down that he had used the calculus to solve all or nearly all of the problems in the Principia. Okay? He then, because nobody knew the calculus, he then recast all the solutions into geometry, so that everybody who read it could understand it. This is a lie. This meretricious statement has become very common and has been repeated over the centuries. I have found it in modern textbooks. It's just, I am assured by people who have spent their life working with on Newton's papers, that this is not true. Still, The mathematics in the Principia is very complex and very difficult. And of course, as I mentioned, since Hooke did not have a very good reputation as a mathematician, it has been often stated that Newton did this to make it impossible for Hooke to understand. The first published account of Newton's work on the calculus came about in John Wallis's book on algebra, published first in 1685 in English, expanded and published in Latin, so it could be read on the continent, in 1693, 9 years after Leibniz's publication, and nearly 30 years after Newton's discovery. Wallis was quite a chauvinistic person, even though the word chauvinistic wasn't invented for about another century and a half. And he wanted credit for English mathematicians in this fact. Leibniz was not a very thorough mathematician. He left out steps and he skipped things and he lost papers, in contrast to Newton, who was the consummate perfectionist. But the real work of developing Leibniz's ideas was not done by Leibniz, was done primarily by two Swiss brothers, Jakob and Johann Bernoulli. These Swiss brothers came from a prominent merchant family in Basel. Johann was 13 years younger than Jakob and possessed a very combative personality. He had originally studied mathematics with his older brother, but he was quickly able to do his own original work in developing Leibniz's calculus. By the way, for those of you who know some calculus, the term integration was invented by Jakob Bernoulli. One of the ways in which mathematicians established their credentials in the 18th century was to invent and then solve really hard problems. They loved doing this, and this was a great challenge. You know, it's kind of like a boxing match for those people who are good with their fists. And in posing and solving such problems, the two brothers had a big fight and broke off their relationship with one another. But both of these men were very significant teachers, especially Johann, who had as his students his son Daniel. He had the Marquis de l'Hôpital, and he had one of my great heroes, Leonhard Euler. All names enshrined in the history of mathematics. But Johann Bernoulli was to play a very difficult, bitter role in the dispute between Leibniz and Newton. And I'll give you an example of his personality by telling you the story about his interaction with his son Daniel. Daniel was a very brilliant mathematician and quite a good physicist himself. And in the years after Newton's death, leading up to about 1733, he did a lot of research, and then in 33 published a book on fluids called Hydrodynamica, in which he invented both the name and the subject of hydrodynamics, and in effect gave his name to the Bernoulli principle, which helps us explain why airplanes fly. This got him considerable acclaim and fame, and his father, Johann, was very angry. So he then copied the book, called it Hydraulica, predated it to 1732, and then claimed that his son had stolen the entire book from him. Now, for a man who, following Newton's death, was considered the greatest mathematician in Europe, I find this quite appalling. In fact, for anybody, I find this quite appalling. But it was always to be the seconds in the duel between Newton and Leibniz, not the principles themselves, who caused the greatest difficulty. Now, and it was in July of 1696 that Bernoulli first introduced the idea that Newton might have plagiarized from Leibniz. Newton, of course, at that time was already in London. He was warden of the Mint. And if Bernoulli on Leibniz's side was causing trouble, then on Newton's side, it was his disgraced but former disciple, Fazio de Douillet, who did the same thing. Whether or not it was with an intent of getting back into Newton's good graces, I don't know. But he made a big attack on Leibniz. And of course, this ignited the fuse first for this great controversy. And this was brought to Leibniz's attention by Mr. Bernoulli. And it took him about a year to respond, and he did so in the Acta Eruditorum, which was basically his journal, in a very denigrating tone, claiming on Newton's part devious practices. But in 1703, there were two major events, one of which I mentioned, I think, yesterday, and that was the death of Robert Hooke. When Hooke died in 1703, Newton could both publish the Optics and go back to the Royal Society, where he quickly became the president. The second was the death of the mathematician John Wallis. Wallis was the last of the older generation of mathematicians. Now, with Collins, with Isaac Barrow, with Oldenburg, and now Wallis, all dead, there was nobody alive who could testify to the fact that Newton had published, had invented the calculus before Leibniz. And I have a picture here of Newton at about roughly 50 years of age, looking very stern with a great wig, and also a picture of his rival, Mr. Leibniz. I'm sorry, they're a little dark, but perhaps you can see them, also with a great wig. The Latin edition of the Optics made Leibniz aware for the first time of the real value of Newton's fluxion method, Newton's calculus, and the fact that it was the same as his with a change of notation. So that, for example, for velocity, we have that formulation from Mr. Leibniz, dx upon dt, x is position and t is time. It means velocity is the change of position with respect to time. Newton, on the other hand, would just use x with a dot upon it, and that's still used on occasion, but the one on the left is far and away commonly used. Leibniz understood and now took the challenge very seriously. One of the problems is that, and we'll come to this, that Leibniz liked to publish his thing, particularly criticisms, anonymously. And this is going to get him into a lot of trouble. Things, however, from about 1705 to 1710 were very quiet, and they probably would have stayed that way, left to Newton and Leibniz. Because Newton was absolutely preeminent in England with a growing reputation on the continent. And on the continent, Leibniz was known as the inventor of the calculus, and along with L'Hôpital and Bernoulli and so forth, was developing all of its implications. However, such peace as there was interrupted by the entrance of a Scot, John Kyle, on the scene. Kyle, who was born in 1671 and died 50 years later, was born in Edinburgh and had been a student of David Gregory, and the nephew of James Gregory, and followed Gregory to Oxford when he became a professor there. Most likely, without Newton's knowledge, Kyle wrote a paper in 1708 in the Philosophical Transactions, and it took 2 years to get published, but he inserted the following gratuitous comment. All of these things follow from the nowadays highly celebrated arithmetic of fluxions, which Mr. Newton, beyond any shadow of doubt, first discovered. And yet the same arithmetic was afterwards published by Mr. Leibniz in the Acta Eruditorum, having changed the name and the symbolism. Moreover, this was published in Latin, so it could particularly be read on the continent, and I can assure you it did not escape attention. By the time it appeared in 1710, Newton was finally busily working away on the second edition of the Principia with his really very good editor, Roger Coates. And his concentration on this job, which is hard for a man approaching 70 years old, was interrupted by the fact that he was also president of the Royal Society. because Kyle's paper could not be ignored by life. I guess it could have been, but he didn't ignore it. And it appeared in the Journal of the Royal Society. Leibniz was a member of the Royal Society and had been so for a lot longer than Kyle. And see, he wrote a year later, 1711, he wrote demanding a retraction and an apology. And he wrote, "Never did I hear the name calculus of fluxion spoken, nor see with these eyes the symbolism that Mr. Newton has employed." And then he wrote, "I am driven to seek a remedy from your distinguished Royal Society." Now, that's a little disingenuous, because he has either purposely or accidentally forgotten that Collins showed him a little bit of Newton's book, The Analisi, back in 1676. And just as it appears always, it's the omission or the forgetting rather than the act itself that gets people in the most trouble. Whatever he may have expected from his complaint, what he got was quite different, because he did not get an apology. He got a tremendous counterattack from Kyle. Kyle had no intention whatsoever of apologizing, and instead he sent Newton a letter in which he included some of the comments that from the Acta Eruditorum that Leibniz had published in his criticism of Newton's book on the optics. And in that criticism, there's a clear accusation that Newton copied the calculus from Mr. Leibniz, clearly stated. Newton, needless to say, was angry. Kyle was to respond to the accusation with gusto, and the battle was really on. So Kyle published his reaction back in the Philosophical Transactions, and Leibniz wrote that no fair-minded or sensible person will think it right that I, at my age, he was 65, appearing like a suitor before a court of law, etc., etc., no reason why I should instruct him, Newton, who is so inexperienced a judge of the manner of discovery. That's not very nice either. Now, the situation was just about to get out of control, because Newton was making devious plans to crush Leibniz. And the means to crush him were given to Newton by Leibniz himself, because he appealed for an apology from the Royal Society, and boy, the Royal Society was about to respond. But the president of the Royal Society was one Isaac Newton. And the Royal Society would be the judge. And so in March of 1712, the president, Mr. Newton himself, appointed a committee to look into the affair. Newton carefully appointed three people to the committee, all very good friends and supporter of his. In order to make it look a little bit fairer, he appointed the ambassador from Prussia as the international expert. He appointed him 3 days before the report was published, so he didn't have a lot of time. Now, the committee had in principle to review decades of letters and papers and so forth. They published within 7 weeks of formation. And the reason they could do it so fast is the report had already been written, and it was written by Isaac Newton himself. And we know that because we have several drafts of the report in Newton's own handwriting. And he had been working on this report for well over a year. No wonder it could be published so quickly. And the report contains the crucial sentence. Newton had already said in February of 1712 that second inventors have no rights, and the report added, "For which reasons we reckon Mr. Newton the first inventor." And they are of the opinion that Mr. Kyle, in asserting the same, has been no ways injurious to Mr. Leibniz. These words, which I have put up here italicized, were italicized by Newton in his own handwriting. This 70-year-old man, and now he was just about approaching his 70th birthday, in fact, here he was 70, over 70, he was running the Royal Mint. He was fighting a battle with John Flamsteed. He was preparing the second edition of the most famous physics work ever written, and he was presiding over the Royal Society, and he was involved in a fight with Leibniz. He was living a very busy life. Now, the conclusion of the report condemned Leibniz as a plagiarist, and one, moreover, who purposely concealed his knowledge of the work of others on which he had depended. It would be hard to imagine a more damning indictment than that, and it was much worse than anything that Kyle had ever written. Newton's soul must really have been deeply touched for him to be so furious. The Society quickly endorsed the report, not surprisingly, and ordered its publication, and it was published on the 8th of January in 1713. Now, it was published in Latin, and I'm now about to make very unhappy my school teacher of Latin, Mr. Stroop, by pronouncing things the way he told me not to pronounce them in Latin class. Poor Mr. Stroop, we always used to call him Campbell's Tomato Stroop, but behind his back. But the Latin title of this work is called the Commercium Epistolicum. And it is the best and most defined statement of Newton's claim to the invention of the calculus. Nowhere is Leibniz's deplorable tendency to anonymous publication more evident than in his response to the Commercium, which he then published in July of 13, and it's called, in his words, the Charta Volans, or Newton loved to call it the flying paper. And it did not contain the name of the author, it did not contain the name of the printer, it didn't even contain the name of the city where it was printed, but it was showed up in the Acta Eruditorum. Now, Newton was hiding behind his committee and John Kyle. Leibniz had in his corner, of course, Johann Bernoulli. Bernoulli was, of course, a brilliant mathematician, and after Leibniz and Newton himself, was probably the greatest mathematician of the time. He, however, being on the continent, really believed very strongly in this Cartesian idea of how forces worked. And then in 1710, back before this appeared, he found an error in the Principia. Now, the error, which he could never find, led to a conclusion which was impossible, and that's what he discovered. Boy, did he take great pleasure in that discovery. And it came to Newton's attention from a French visitor who then came to London and told Newton about it. Newton, of course, quickly found the actual error itself, and then because of the second edition of the Principia coming out, wrote to his editor, Roger Coates, in 1712, that it would be necessary to reprint a sheet and a half in the second book, Problem 3. The error was a very simple one. Newton was deeply embarrassed. This is the second time he made an error in public. Probably a rare thing that anybody only errs in public twice in their life. But by the time of Newton's correction, Johann had already published the fact that Newton had made an error, and in not only to Leibniz in a letter, but he had also announced it to the Académie des Sciences in Paris, greatly disparaging Newton both in terms of mathematics and in terms of now of physics. But Newton admitted in the preface to the second edition that he had corrected some errors in the first one. He did not acknowledge Bernoulli, of course, but he didn't even acknowledge Roger Coates, who, with his very clever, smart, and gifted intelligence, had discovered several other errors. So Newton, who was sharply critical himself, was very chary with praise or gratitude. Now, in Switzerland, where he was now working as professor in Basel, Johann got a copy of the Commercium, and he sent a letter off to Leibniz, who was living in Vienna. And he then condemned, in that letter, he condemned Newton as a man who couldn't possibly understand anything. And he wrote, "At any rate, it is clear that the true way of differentiating differentials was not known to Newton until long after it was familiar to us." He was very nasty, but then he wrote the following: "I beg you to use what I write properly and not to involve me with Newton and his people, for I'm reluctant to be involved in these disputes or to be ungrateful to Newton, who has heaped many testimonies of his goodwill upon me." He was very two-faced. And because of this letter, the Charta Volans appeared within a few weeks. Moreover, in his criticism of Newton, Leibniz did not miss a trick, because he included statements about how many fights Newton had had with both Flamsteed and Hooke. With the publication of these two documents, the Commercium and the Charta, it's clear that no compromise was possible, and this was a fight to the death, and as we shall see, well beyond it. Newton's reluctance to publish, as I've said several times, caused tremendous delays in the progress of both mathematics and science, and I think that is very much to his discredit. Of course, Newton had numerous advantages that were denied to Leibniz. He was president of the Royal Society. He lived in London, the intellectual capital of the world. Kyle was close by in Oxford. Leibniz was in Vienna, the far edge of the universe as far as Europe was concerned. And Bernoulli was now in Basel, this tiny little Swiss city. They thought that this would be corrected by the accession to the throne of George I, following the death of Queen Anne in 1714. George I was also the Elector of Hanover, the boss of Gottfried Leibniz, and they thought that this would help Leibniz's side in England. But reality is often much more complicated, because George I had a son, the Prince of Wales, who then became George II. The father and son did not get along, and the Prince of Wales was married to a very intelligent woman, Princess Caroline of Ansbach. She was very interested in philosophy and became interested and supportive of Isaac Newton. And so the advantage of the House of Hanover was balanced quite a bit. However, the fact that this became known in court also made it open to high society at that time, and this argument became a source of great mirth to the court, throughout the British court. By 1714, the argument expanded from pure mathematics into physics, with the entrance of an argument about Cartesian vortices, tourbillons spinning around, pressing against one another, and Newton's concepts of action at a distance. In that year, letters between Newton and Kyle flew back and forth. But poor Leibniz was often unable to respond, because first, he was not a very good person at keeping records. Second, because he had to keep moving around from job to job, and he lost papers as he was moving. In early 1715, less than 2 years before his death, Leibniz got yet another letter from Bernoulli, and this letter, in reading this letter, the argument now went into metaphysics, because Leibniz responded, "When I was told that Newton says something extraordinary about God in the Latin editions of his Optics, which until then I had not seen, I examined it and I laughed at the idea that space is the sensorium of God, as if God, from whom everything comes, should have need of a sensorium." Now, in the Optics, Newton was attacking the idea that space was filled with this stuff, this plenum, to carry the hypothetical vortices of Descartes. He was not suggesting anything about the powers of God. However, by now, any stick to beat the enemy was of use. And finally, another person entered the argument, the Abbe Antonio Scinella Conti, a Venetian. And he came to the court of King George to support Leibniz's side from the continent. And he met Princess Caroline, and together they thought that they could mediate the dispute. But there's a picture of the princess. And as so often happens for those people who tried to step in and settle an argument, both sides wound up hating everybody, hating the mediators. Just as an aside, even though I'm way over time, George II apparently really loved this woman, so that in his will, when he died, he asked that the side of his coffin be left open, so that when she were buried, in the same fashion, their dust could commingle forever. Very sweet. And we shall see more of Conti tomorrow. He was not a very pleasant character. Caroline wrote the following: "Great men are like women who never give up their lovers except with the utmost chagrin and mortal anger." And that, gentlemen, is where your opinions have been. In October of 1716, Leibniz wrote, "Monsieur Newton believes that the force of the universe diminishes like that of a watch and has to be reestablished by a special action of God." Now, to a man of Newton's profound religious belief, to accuse him of denying the perfection of his God was the worst possible thing you can do. It was much worse than calling him a plagiarist. We'll see what his reply was. Leibniz, however, was declining in health and withdrawing from the world. And finally, in November of 16, a letter from the Abbe Conti came to Newton saying, "Monsieur Leibniz est mort et la dispute est finie." But the dispute was far from finie. Newton dragged the memory of Leibniz to the same stone wall he used to rub the nose of his opponent. And the argument continued for years and years. There is a shocking comment recorded about Isaac Newton. He told Dr. Clark that he had broke Leibniz's heart with his reply to him. Pleasantly told him. Pleasantly. But to me, after all, a member of the Royal Society was condemned as a plagiarist by the Royal Society, the most significant scientific group in the world. But nothing to me seems as outrageous as Newton's publication of a new Latin version of the Commercium in 1722. This is 6 years after Leibniz has died. He's publishing yet again this diatribe against a man long dead. He just couldn't let go of his anger any more than he could let go of his publications. And just as he had erased Flamsteed's name from the second edition of the Principia, in 1726 he published a third edition and erased Leibniz's name from that. Leibniz had died on the... this contest, which transcended specific issues of invention, embraced rival connections of the nature of matter, of substance, of God's providence, of time, of space, of miracles, and their common commitment to developing the new philosophy was lost. Leibniz died, and the quote is, "his closing years enfeebled by disease, harassed by controversy, embittered by neglect." And my final slide comes. He was buried in Berlin. The only person there was his secretary. It's a tragic end for one of the greatest figures in history. Now, having overrun by lots of time, I will end here. Tomorrow we will have, the death of the great man himself and some of the things that he influenced following his lifetime. I will hang around for questions, and I'll be outside for questions. But thank you very much.